want to turn our attention now to arthritis. The American Arthritis Foundation says arthritis is the leading cause of disability in the U.S. If you're one of the many who experience pain in your joints, you know that managing your condition is important to everyday life. Larry Mueller here, talking about rheumatoid arthritis and osteoarthritis with our guest, Dr. Catherine Finn, with us. She's a board-certified rheumatologist who practices at the Rheumatic Disease Center in Glendale. Dr. Finn is also a member of the Wisconsin Rheumatology Association. As we talk with Dr. Finn, I hope you'll join in. Let us know how arthritis affects your life. Did you develop the pain after an injury, or maybe is aging taking a toll on your joints? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Dr. Catherine Finn, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here.
Let's talk about the diseases you treat at the Rheumatic Disease Center.
Sure. So where our specialty lies as rheumatologists is really in treating autoimmune-related arthritis, and then we also manage some osteoarthritis as well. So autoimmune arthritis is going to include what you mentioned, rheumatoid arthritis, also includes psoriatic arthritis, lupus, ankylosing spondylitis, which is another form of autoimmune arthritis that affects the low back and sometimes other joints. We treat some rare autoimmune diseases, something called vasculitis, which involves inflammation of the vessels. We treat scleroderma, which is a disease which involves tightening and fibrosis of the skin. And then we treat osteoarthritis, which is a lot more common than all of the ones that I mentioned. We also treat gout. So that is something that comes up quite often and is quite prevalent.
Yeah. So there are lots of forms of arthritis. They're similar, I suppose, in some ways, but you were describing the differences there. It's quite a bit different, quite a bit of difference depending on which type you were talking about there.
Exactly. I mean, they certainly can all create a lot of pain and a lot of dysfunction and affect daily activities and daily life. But they are different, and a lot of them are treated differently. When we look at our autoimmune-related arthropathies, actually a lot of the treatment options will sort of work no matter what you have. Mm-hmm. But those treatment options do not really apply to osteoarthritis. So most of the things that we use for autoimmune arthritis, and we've had all of this advancement in our treatment options, you know, over the past 20 years, so many more options, that unfortunately we haven't seen that same thing happen in osteoarthritis. Hopefully we will see that at some point. The treatments are quite different. When we think about osteoarthritis, the list is much, it's just much shorter, unfortunately, although that affects almost everyone at some point.
Yeah, almost everyone, hopefully not in the younger ages. I mean, do we see it among younger folks? I mean, it's older folks, you know, I'm in that category. I just have a little in my hands and so forth, but not bad.
Yeah. You know, you can see it in younger individuals. If you've had an injury, that is going to probably give you some earlier osteoarthritis. So we think about the primary form of osteoarthritis, which sort of goes along with wear and tear aging process. But there's things that can kind of speed it along. So one of those things would be injury.
Yeah.
So that could be like a mechanical injury, like ACL tear or whatever. Or we can see earlier osteoarthritis in our patients who also have the inflammatory type of arthritis, because the inflammatory type of arthritis has damaged the joint and then it wears abnormally and then you develop osteoarthritis. So we call that secondary osteoarthritis. So usually primary osteoarthritis, you know, 40s and beyond is kind of, I would say. But for secondary osteoarthritis, certainly in some of my younger patients who have had damage, it can happen. Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, Angie in Madison has a question relating to juvenile arthritis, I believe. Angie, are you there?
Yeah, thanks. I was diagnosed with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis when I was about 8 years old. And it went into remission when I was about 12 or 13, and I haven't had any symptoms since, and I'm, you know, very active. And I was just wondering if that usually comes back later in life and if there's things that people can do to kind of help prevent it from coming back, or is it just kind of luck of the draw?
Yeah, that's a great question. So kids a lot of times have the experience that you had, thankfully, where it goes away. It goes into remission, and it really doesn't come back. And that's the majority of cases of juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, or we now call it juvenile idiopathic arthritis, and there's a few different forms. But if you went into remission at age 12 or 13, I would expect you to stay there. Look, that is an autoimmune condition, so that can give you a little bit of a higher risk of getting some other autoimmune thing later in life. I do have some patients that do develop something else later, but the vast majority do not. I mean, in terms of preventative stuff, I would say the things that I say to everyone, healthy lifestyle, really, don't smoke. That's a biggie, because we know smoking can really increase your risk of autoimmunity, especially rheumatoid arthritis. Being at a healthy weight, we know that obesity can also increase risk of autoimmune problems, and probably dietary stuff, you know, avoiding the stuff that we all know is not good for us and is inflammatory, so the processed foods and sugars and whatnot. That's kind of my best advice regarding trying to avoid getting another autoimmune condition. I think a lot of it really falls in that lifestyle. But the good news is, I think that the odds are in your favor that you probably won't develop something else.
Angie, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Mary wonders, what is autoimmune?
Sure. So autoimmunity happens when the body creates a self-directed protein. So we call these antibodies, and they can be tested in the blood. Some of our diseases that we treat as rheumatologists, and then there's lots of other kinds of autoimmune diseases involving different organs of the body. Some of them have identifiable antibodies and some do not. But that's kind of the general process by which this happens, is that something happens, and it's probably multiple, sort of this multi-hit theory. So maybe some genetic predisposition, maybe an environmental exposure, you know, maybe exposure to a virus or smoking or something, something like that, which then triggers this triggers autoimmunity. So then there's the state of autoimmunity where you have the antibody, and then there's autoimmune disease. So those are two separate things, and I think it's an important point, which is that you can have positive autoantibodies in your blood, but that doesn't always translate into autoimmune disease. So disease is where you actually have the symptoms, right? So you can have like a positive marker for rheumatoid arthritis or a positive marker for lupus, which is called an ANA test, but not actually have the disease. So that's also where lifestyle, perhaps preventative stuff can come in, is in that space where you have some autoimmunity, but you don't have autoimmune disease.
Beth emailed us. She's been having knee pain for a couple of weeks now, can't put her weight on it, mostly right, but some left involvement, and the right hip hurts as well. No injury. X-rays shows mild to moderate arthritis. Right is greater than left. Beth will start physical therapy next week. Anti-inflammatory doesn't help, or doesn't seem to help anyway. Is there a point where Beth should consider systemic disease and go back to a medical doctor?
So I think she's on the right track here in terms of the treatment plan. Sounds like she has mild to moderate arthritis on the x-ray. We have to keep in mind that an x-ray doesn't really tell you what's going on in those other structures. I'm not suggesting that she needs further imaging, but we always keep that in mind. So it's not going to tell you if she had some kind of meniscal problem or tendon issue or ligament problem. It won't tell that. It'll just tell that she has underlying osteoarthritis, which can certainly cause her symptoms. There doesn't always have to be an inciting incident. Sometimes we get these flares and we're not really sure why it happened. Typically, the things that she mentioned that she's going to be doing are the first step. So we talk about an anti-inflammatory. That can be either oral, so things like ibuprofen, naproxen, if that's appropriate for her. There are some people in whom that kind of medication can cause problems. You can also use topical non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Voltaren gel, or also called diclofenac, is now available over the counter. And I really like that because it avoids having to take it by mouth. You avoid any chance for gut irritation, and it can really help. So you apply it just to where you're having the issue. So she would put it on her knee, and she could use it up to four times a day. And I really like that as sort of another adjunct therapy. Physical therapy often really helps too. So I think give that a fair chance. And if she does the physical therapy or if it's getting worse, that's when you go back. And sometimes these things, you know, it's just time.
Yeah, yeah. Dr. Catherine Finn, our guest today, board certified rheumatologist. It's great to have her with us. And you can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. What are the red flags that you may have an autoimmune arthritis?
Yeah, so there are a few things that should prompt you to get more evaluation. If you have something that comes on sort of overnight, you feel fine, and then the next day, boy, both my shoulders and hips hurt. And that goes on. It doesn't go away, and it's been a week or two. That would be something. So this kind of sudden onset, oftentimes if it's bilateral, so if we're seeing it on both sides and it's symmetrical, and again, that you're getting, when you could sort of say, geez, this started around this time, and I didn't have this problem before. That should also sort of raise a bit of a red flag. The other thing that we'll often see with inflammatory arthritis, which is what I call this autoimmune arthritis, is inflammatory arthritis versus osteoarthritis is more mechanical. So with inflammatory arthritis is morning stiffness. So wake up in the morning and you feel like it's very hard to move. Now that can happen with osteoarthritis or mechanical arthritis, but typically that time frame is going to be less than 30 minutes and less than an hour of morning stiffness. There are exceptions, but typically. So that would be another red flag. If you're having hours of morning stiffness, if you're having swelling in the hands, it's hard to make a fist. It like hurts to make a fist. It feels tight. If you're having other systemic symptoms like weight loss, fevers, we can sometimes see. So weight loss, it's unintentional. Fevers, fatigue, which is out of the ordinary. Those are kind of some general things. You know, there's a lot of little things that when I see my patients for the first time, I generally have people in for an hour because we do a very comprehensive review of systems, we call it. So we talk about, you know, every different kind of symptom to see if there's something else that, because these are systemic conditions. And so sometimes these little symptoms can be important. But the ones that I just mentioned, I think those are, if I was going to give, you know, five red flag symptoms, that would be what it is. And these are the ones I generally tell my patients in the office.
Chris Call couldn't stay with us. How could a rheumatologist help Chris with fibromyalgia? And can you talk about the connection between Lyme's disease and joint pain?
Sure. So fibromyalgia is a admittedly something that is quite hard to treat. As rheumatologists, we sometimes treat it. It's more often managed by primary care doctors. I think there has, over time, we have gained a greater understanding of perhaps why this disease is happening. So for anyone who doesn't know what fibromyalgia is, so fibromyalgia is this condition that causes widespread pain. So patients have pain in all four quadrants of their body on most days of the week. They have a lot of tender points, just light touch is going to hurt. It can come along with other sensitivities, for example, light sensitivity, sound sensitivity, that sort of thing. We'll see it come a lot of times in conjunction with things like an IBS or irritable bowel syndrome. So this condition, I think the way that it really responds best, although I think it's difficult, is sort of these lifestyle things. So patients need to make sure they're getting enough sleep. They need to make sure they're eating well, getting some movement. Movement is key when it comes to this widespread pain. So there have been studies that have been done on some of the medications which are used to treat fibromyalgia. And what they did is they took patients who were taking that treatment and patients who were doing an intervention, which was yoga. And those patients who were doing the yoga consistently had a sustained positive response. As opposed to the patients who took the medication, they had an initial response to the drug, but that kind of waned over time. And we often see that with these drugs, which is why I don't prefer them, because I think they're just not, they're not durable. We don't get a good, durable response from them. A lot of times they sort of, and that's not everyone, right? There are some people who get a good, who get a good response to these, and it does last over time. But I think talking about the lifestyle stuff is really important. So I mentioned sleep, I mentioned diet, movement. Then we want to manage any other health problem that's going on. If there's a thyroid problem going on, we got to manage that. If there's rheumatoid arthritis going on, we need to manage that, because typically if something else is flaring systemically, it's going to cause the fibromyalgia oftentimes to flare up too. Mm. So that's something that we need to think about. And then also thinking about just mental health. How is the person feeling overall? Is there depression that's untreated? Is there untreated anxiety, which is leading to other problems like sleep problems and so on? So there's a lot of different pieces to this.
Yeah.
And it's hard. I think it's hard. I think that you've got to have a good primary care doctor, because they can also manage some of these other things, which maybe a sleep study is needed. You know, if you're not having restorative sleep, and you already have a tendency for fibromyalgia, it's probably going to be a problem. So the thing that's being recognized, I think, more is that fibromyalgia is sort of this nerve problem. So it's not really a problem of the muscles or joints. It's more of a problem of nerves. So they're overactive. That's why pain sensitivity to light touch.
Hmm. You know, I was recalling our conversation of 20 minutes ago when we were talking about the importance of exercise for mm-hmm. our mental health. And if your foot hurts or your knee hurts, you can't get the exercise. It can be sort of a, you know, recurring thing here, and a system that it's hard to get out of.
Yes, it certainly is a vicious circle. I think the important thing to remember is the exercise doesn't even have to be weight bearing. It could be chair yoga. It could be simple stretches. And that's some of the stuff that is studied in fibromyalgia. It could be water exercise. That one tends to be really, really good. That helps for people who have either a lot of arthritis or fibromyalgia. So fibromyalgia tends to be, you can overdo it. There's this concept of like you overdo it. So vigorous exercise is generally not the best for fibromyalgia. It's kind of these slow stretching exercises, light aerobic activity, but water exercise can be very, very therapeutic.
Makes good sense to me. You can join in, too, with your own thoughts or questions with our guest, Dr. Catherine Finn, who is a board-certified rheumatologist, practices at the Rheumatic Disease Center in Glendale, Wisconsin. It's great to have her with us today. Peter in Dallas, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I mean, in terms of osteoarthritis, I've had both knees, both hips replaced. I'm a retired plumber, and now I'm working with my hands, which I've discovered that you can also get osteoarthritis and inflammatory arthritis in your hands. But I was supposed to have surgery in 2020, and with COVID, I just dropped it, and I started doing acupuncture, which has been fantastic. But I've also continued to take meloxicam and then Tylenol 8-hour arthritis, which keeps everything under control. But I've also, my acupuncture suggested a blend of turmeric and fresh ginger with some orange and lemon as an anti-inflammatory, and I'm curious to see what your thoughts are on that.
Great question. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. So there's a lot of interest in supplements, vitamins for osteoarthritis. There have been studies that have looked at these things to see how patients respond to them. Turmeric has repeatedly in well-done randomized controlled trials shown to be effective for osteoarthritis pain. So I would say go for it. So turmeric, the dosing is typically 500 to 1,000 milligrams daily in these trials, or you could do 1 teaspoon of the spice added into whatever that you're having. It outperformed doing nothing, which when we talk about osteoarthritis, that is important because osteoarthritis, consistently in these clinical trials, there will be a 30% placebo response, which is really higher than we see in other conditions. And that is consistent across studies. So when we look at osteoarthritis, you could almost understand why it's hard to get positive trials, right? Because we have this huge placebo effect, which is consistent. But turmeric did beat out that placebo effect and has done so numerous clinical trials. So I do tell my patients about turmeric, and I think it doesn't work for everyone, but I do think that for some people, it really helps.
Peter, there you go. And he also mentioned acupuncture.
Yeah, I think we don't have enough data on it, but I don't think it's going to hurt. And I think if you have, so when we think about osteoarthritis, we're really talking about the joint. But there are periarticular, which just means tissues around the joint. So we have muscle, tendon, myofascial, all that stuff that surrounds the joint. And when we have a problem that's going on in the joint, that can lead to other problems that are going on around the joint. And acupuncture, I think, can really help with that aspect of it. So we think about acupuncture or dry needling, working with the myofascial tissues to release them, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It can be a really nice adjunctive therapy. And again, for some people, it really helps.
Peter, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. We had another listener emailed us who's diagnosed with giant cell arthritis after having a headache on top of the right side of their head. They would love to hear you talk about giant cell arthritis.
Sure. So giant cell, it's actually giant cell arteritis. So it is one of these vascular diseases. So it's an inflammation of the vessels of the scalp. So the temporal artery becomes inflamed. Patients will get temporal artery or temporal pain, like a headache. It will be persistent. It can be one side or both, and will respond beautifully to high-dose steroid, that at this time is sort of the mainstay and has been for years treatment that we use. The exciting thing about this space is that we are having new approvals for medications that can help people get off steroids faster. So as I think most of us know, steroids, look, we love them and we hate them. They work really nicely, predictably, and fast, but they have a whole host of side effects. And so it's hard with some of these really inflammatory diseases that respond to prednisone. Patients get stuck on prednisone for years. So there are new medications that have been approved. There was one that was approved probably 3 or 4 years ago for giant cell arteritis. And that is called Actemra. It's a weekly or biweekly shot that patients can just give themselves. And this is very timely because I think it was just last week, there's another approval for something called upadacitinib, which is a pill, which has been approved also for giant cell arteritis. And that can help us to get patients off prednisone. So the concern with giant cell arteritis is that because we're dealing with vessels that are in close proximity to the eye, we can have optic nerve ischemia, which can lead to blindness. So this is truly something that we take very, very seriously, hence giving 60 milligrams plus at times of steroid. And so it's great to have some other treatment options here that can potentially replace the steroid. Look, right off the bat, steroid is king for this. We still use it, but I think over time and over the next years, you know, that will change.
Yeah, yes, well, that's the hope. Dr. Catherine Finn, our guest today, a board-certified rheumatologist, and she'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. Great to have her along, and you'll be able to join in with your questions as well. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Coming up on
Larry Mueller here for WPR News, talking about different types of arthritis on the show today. You'll hear how these conditions affect your body and the options you have for treatment with our guest, Dr. Catherine Finn. She's a board-certified rheumatologist, practices at the Rheumatic Disease Center in Glendale, Wisconsin, also a member of the Wisconsin Rheumatology Association. Our lines are full, so I think we'll just go right to the phones and to Pat in Milwaukee. Pat, thank you for calling.
You're welcome. Aloha, Larry and Dr. Finn, our neighbor. Milwaukee's not far from Glendale. Just wanted to say two comments. The first is the warm water exercise is phenomenal. Osteoarthritis is what I face, as is turmeric and cinnamon in smoothies, in your scrambled eggs, whatever, and on your oatmeal. And then nutrition is extremely important. I go on Wednesdays to the Gerald L. Ignis Indian Health Center on the south side of Milwaukee, and we have a program that combines an hour of exercise plus a nutrition lesson and a main dish, a side, and a dessert that are all diabetic and healthy friendly, and I've made so many of those. They also have a program for diabetes, and everybody in that program over a period of many weeks has lost numerous pounds. And the last thing I will mention is when you go on vacation, if you have osteoarthritis, you might expect the unexpected. Trip to Croatia, day number 4, broke both legs. Tibia was so shattered that it looked like a box of broken toothpicks in the x-ray. And I'm still using my cane. And this happened, I was in the Dubrovnik Orthopedic Trauma Hospital October 7th through 13th of 2023. And I'm still using a cane.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, gosh. Pat. Very sorry to hear that. But her other comments, I think, were about water therapy and nutrition were spot on.
Yeah, I think those were really great points. Thank you, Pat. It's always good to hear it from someone who's done it and who can speak for it, because I do think some of these things really help. And just to speak to her unfortunate fracture that she had, so fractures, you know, while I don't know what her fracture resulted from, there is another condition of the bones, which is called osteoporosis or osteopenia, which can lead to the fractures. Now, of course, those who have arthritis may have mobility issues, and so that may lead to a fall, and then that can lead to a fracture. So that there are some connections there. But it's actually a different issue.
Yeah, a different issue. But, Pat, I'm sorry for the accident, and appreciate your call and your comments very much. Kim in Eau Claire, we'll go to you. Hi, Kim.
Hello, Larry. Hello, doctor. I was calling. I've got gout, and I'm on 300 milligrams of allopurinol. I was wondering, because my uric acid levels are still very high, how much damage am I still doing to my joints?
Good question. Well, how high is your uric acid? Do you know?
No, I don't know offhand.
You don't know. Okay. So then I'll give you some kind of generalism. So typically we want your uric acid to be less than 6. So if you're more than 6, you're at a more increased risk of having flares of your gout. And flares can lead to joint damage. Are you having a lot of flares?
No, I haven't had a flare in I don't know how many years. I just read an article, I guess. The reason I read an article stating that the crystals are still there even though you're not having attacks and they're damaging your joints because of the high uric acid.
Sure, I can speak to that. Yeah. So gout is a crystal arthritis, just as you said. And what happens is the crystals come out of solution and they precipitate in and around the joint and create this massive inflammatory response. What they can also do is form what's called tophi, which are sort of a ball of the uric acid crystals, which can damage the joint. They can cause these big erosions in the joints, which can be pretty dramatic looking. So over time, if you take allopurinol at the appropriate dose that is getting your uric acid to less than 6, these deposits of uric acid crystals can dissolve. They can go away. It takes a while, but that can happen. In more severe cases of gout, which we call tophaceous gout, this is where we can actually see the gouty crystals deposited in the soft tissue and around the joint. It's visible on exam. For some of these patients, there's another treatment and probably another one that will be coming, which can more rapidly dissolve these gout crystals. It's not for everyone, but for some patients, it really, really helps. So I think it depends on what the caller's uric acid is, whether he, you know, has ongoing chronic inflammation, because that's really our marker for this, for gout. The marker for gout is that uric acid. That's how we can kind of know if the joints are quiet and if we're reducing your risk of having flares.
Mm. Kim, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Gary in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Gary.
Well, hello. I have a question about vasculitis. I know this program is mostly about arthritis, but I was hit with a case of vasculitis almost exactly 3 years ago, and it was intense. I survived and I came out of it, and it's been in remission now for over 2 years, but the damage that it caused still gives me pain. And I did gabapentin, which I know it works because every so often I try to back off of it and I got to go back on. I don't take much, 600 milligrams a day. But I heard you mention earlier, I recall when I was on steroids, the steroids are very effective, but I know you can't stand them forever. Earlier, you mentioned a medication that was used in place of steroid. I'd be curious about that. And I'd also be curious about any opinion you have about ways to mitigate this remaining pain from the damage. That is the biggest problem now. And I also want to make a comment, too. My doctors have taken very good care of me, but nobody has ever expressed any interest in why this happened. I mean, I know there must have been something in the environment or whatever that caused this, because it hit so hard and so fast, and nobody has ever really said, well, it happened because of this, that, or the other thing. And I'm curious to know what you say about that. Your office is only about 2 miles away from where I live, and I'll be glad to make an appointment.
So first I would ask you, Gary, what kind of vasculitis did you have?
I've heard the terminology a couple of times. I will give you the consequence of getting it. I was hit hard, ended up in a coma for 6 days, in the hospital for a month. I have nerve damage in both feet and my left hand. I lost 30 inches of my small intestine, and this all happened in an instant.
Okay.
I don't know exactly what. I do know that the tests they give me are for ANCA-C and myelofibrosis.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. Okay, so and it sounds like you went into remission, which is great. Did you got Rituxan? I'm assuming.
Yes, I did. I started out with cyclotoxin, but then I went to Rituxan, and I haven't had an infusion of that for about a year and a half now.
Okay. So for everyone, ANCA vasculitis is a small vessel vasculitis, which can affect multiple different organ systems. So where you have a small vessel, just about, it can affect that. So it commonly will cause nerve damage. And it sounds like that is what you are suffering from. Nerve damage is difficult because nerves are just difficult. They can be damaged. And then even though the insult is gone, the inflammation is gone, the pain and symptoms may continue. That's where your gabapentin comes in, because that is directed at nerve pain. It's not an anti-inflammatory. It sounds like your doctors think you are in remission. So prednisone or some of these other medications which are approved for vasculitis, and that's actually a different kind of vasculitis. Not to say that we may not be using those for what you had in the future, but those are a little bit different. But I think it sounds like your problems are due to the sequela of prior inflammation. So I think gabapentin's a great choice. Admittedly, it's hard to treat these nerve problems. We think about diabetic neuropathy. You know, we think about ongoing pain from having shingles. It can be really debilitating and really difficult to treat. So I don't think steroids necessarily would have a place here. But, you know, I'm just kind of going by what you're telling me and without the full information. And then when you asked about cause of vasculitis, probably no one gave you an answer because we just don't know. We just don't know. Just like other forms of autoimmunity, because this is an autoimmune disease, maybe genetics play a role here. Not that you have to have a relative with an autoimmune disease, but we do see that happen. Environmental factors, viruses can be a trigger, maybe some kind of other environmental exposure. We don't really know. Mm. We don't really know. It's probably multi-hit, like I was saying before, you know. It's not just one thing. More than one thing has to go wrong for the immune system to go a little wacky. Same thing with cancer, right? Cancer is also immune regulated. It's different, but same concept, where it's probably multiple things have to go wrong in order for a cancer to develop or an autoimmune disease to develop. Stress is a factor too, which I didn't mention before, but I think it's a trigger. I think you probably already have some of these other risk factors going on, and then stress is a trigger. I hear this a lot. I had a stressful event, you know, a family member was ill or something at work or whatever it might be. And then the next month I started getting these symptoms. I hear that a lot.
Mm. Gary, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And go ahead and make your appointment. There you go, Gary. Thanks very much. Appreciate your call. Teresa in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking the call. I love everything I've been listening to so far, and I lost an aunt to rheumatoid arthritis at 70, and I myself have been diagnosed with everything under the sun in the autoimmune area, and they just landed on undifferentiated connective tissue disorder. I was on methotrexate, and I told I'd be on it for life. But in working with, like you said, sleep, stress, exercise, but mainly the microbiome and adjusting my diet, I've worked off of those medicines for several years now and have been maintaining lack of flare-ups, like no flares. And so I'm wondering, in your practice, how much more are you hearing about microbiome? How much more are you looking at microbiome and its impact on all inflammation diseases?
Great question. Thank you for that. I think the answer is it certainly plays a role. We don't know exactly. I keep saying that a lot. We don't know. We don't know. It's true. We just don't know exactly how it fits in and how it's different in each individual. So, for example, I wouldn't be able to tell you a diet which suits your exact microbiome because everyone is a little bit different. I can tell you that it's being studied. And there are positive studies in our autoimmune patients where we see an altered microbiome, an altered gut microbiome in patients who have an autoimmune arthritis versus those who don't, a healthy control. So there is something going on here. And it makes sense, right? I definitely see it in clinical practice where people change their diet, clean up their diet, take some things out, eliminate things, or simply eat cleaner, and they're better. They're better. So, and I think the other part of this is just metabolic health. It certainly plays a role here. There will be a lot more to come on this because of the prevalence of GLP-1s, Ozempic, tirzepatide, et cetera. A lot of our patients who have autoimmune diseases are taking these medications and having a positive response. So I don't have any real data for this, but we see people get better. Is it just from weight loss? Is it from a general, you know, decrease in inflammation from other reasons other than the weight loss? What is it exactly? Does it have to do with the gut microbiome? I don't know, but it's an important piece. And I hope that our research keeps going in that direction because that's sort of this root cause medicine. If we can really get at what's actually going wrong here, we can help for all our treatments to work better. Or maybe in some select people, they won't need it anymore. And, you know, when we talk about this undifferentiated connective tissue disease, yeah, it sort of falls in this class where patients can have multiple different autoimmune symptoms, but they don't necessarily meet criteria for one particular disease, say lupus or rheumatoid arthritis. And so that's sort of what we call it. At the end of the day, we treat based on what symptoms are present. So it almost doesn't matter a whole lot what the label is because we treat the symptoms. So that's why methotrexate, totally appropriate for joint-related symptoms. That's one of our go-to medications. But I think, yeah, across the board, improvement in lifestyle, in diet, I've seen it really, really help people.
Yeah. Teresa, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. Madeline and DePere, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Madeline.
Hello. I was diagnosed with pseudogout. What's the difference between regular gout and pseudogout? And how do they test for that that acid level? How do they test for that?
Great question. Thank you, Madeline. So pseudogout is kind of a cousin of gout. It is another crystal disease, but it has nothing to do with uric acid. It's actually a crystal deposition of something called calcium pyrophosphate. We also call it CPPD, or calcium pyrophosphate deposition disease. This can present exactly the same as gout, an intensely swollen, painful, red-hot joint. It can be in the big toe just like gout and so painful you can't put a shoe on it. It can be mistaken for a fracture. I mean, it's intensely painful. So there's a few different forms. There's one which is called acute pseudogout. So that's when you get this flare, which looks like a gout flare. It's typically treated with non-steroidals like ibuprofen, aleve naproxen, sometimes some prednisone, sometimes colchicine, which is another anti-inflammatory. Then there's another form of pseudogout, which is more chronic. It can look like other forms of autoimmune arthritis. This is not an autoimmune arthritis, though. It can look like rheumatoid, or it can look like another inflammatory arthritis in that you have chronic swelling. It often happens in the wrist. And the way that we diagnose this is based on x-rays, some blood work, because we would check a uric acid, and aspirating the joint. Sticking a needle in the joint, if it's swollen, get some fluid out. We put it on a slide and put it under the microscope, and we can see these rhomboid-shaped crystals. When we look at a gout crystal, it's shaped like a spindle, or like a, like a needle. It's a needle.
Okay.
As opposed to the rhomboid shape. So when we talk about treating pseudogout, chronic pseudogout, anti-inflammatories is still kind of where it's at with this. Sometimes we'll try more advanced treatments, but also important point, pseudogout has nothing to do with the diet. It has nothing to do with the diet. It goes along with osteoarthritis. Those two are heavily linked. Sometimes if your magnesium levels are low, it can give you increased chance of pseudogout. If you've had damage in a joint, pseudogout likes to form there. But it's a different crystal disease.
Madeline, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Greg from Madison emailed us. He has pain in his wrists. He thought it was from working on a computer for 30 years. At first, he assumed it would be carpal tunnel, but it's traveled to his wrist, to the base of his thumbs. He thought it could be something like arthritis or even delayed reaction to Lyme disease that he contracted in 2021. Any suggestions?
Did he say if this is just one wrist or both?
He said both.
Okay. So, and not knowing a lot about how old he is, et cetera, pain at the base of the thumb is usually osteoarthritis. That's really common to get at the base of the thumb, and you can understand why, because it's a very used joint.
Yeah.
So that's my first thought on this. If it's truly the wrist, and so that would be more in the middle as opposed to the base of the thumb, that could be, that kind of broadens the differential a little bit, if you will. But so just hearing base of the thumb, it sounds like osteoarthritis. He can try some Voltaren gel. I really like that for this. He could use some immobilization, a spica splint. You can buy these online on Amazon. They're like $10. Wear it at nighttime, put some Voltaren gel on first, wear it at night, just immobilize it. And if it still persists, an x-ray. Go see his primary care, get an x-ray.
And I guess it started at his wrist and then went to his thumbs.
Oh, it started at the wrist into the thumb. It's hard to say, because sometimes when you have arthritis at the base of the thumb, it kind of, because it's adjacent to the wrist, right? So it can be a little tricky to tell that apart. Getting an x-ray is not wrong here, because he could have something, he could have a ligament problem in the wrist that can cause swelling. So I think that would help.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Boy, we've covered a whole lot here today, and I still have 20 questions that I could ask you, Dr. Finn, but I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I learned a lot, and I think our listeners did as well. And will you come back and be with us again? Love to have you back.
I sure would. It was an honor to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Catherine Finn, our guest, board-certified rheumatologist, practices at the Rheumatic Disease Center in Glendale, Wisconsin. She's also a member of the Wisconsin Rheumatology Association. We'll get her back and talk again. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's kind of the way it works around here. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention to your skin and talk about skin care as we get into from spring and then on into summer. Dr. Apple Bodimer next. I'm Larry Mueller.